Now it's time to get back to the second hour of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
All right, welcome back to the show, folks. On this segment of the show, we're really happy to introduce you all to Suzanne Dion, a local friend and celebrity in her own right, who is a self-awareness teacher and educator for developmental change. And she's deeply committed to a system of understanding change through what's known as the Enneagram system.
Mm-hmm. Which and we're big fans of ourselves.
It's understood as a sort of a way of developing self-awareness. My understanding is that it helps you understand humanity by having 9 different types of people, essentially, that allow you to identify who you're dealing with in the world.
Absolutely right, yes.
Okay, and in a sense, we have astrology that a lot of people know and are committed to that has 12 essential different types of people. Is there any correlation in your mind between the Enneagram and astrology?
Well, that's a big question, and I have studied astrology and birth charts, and I have found them to be really fascinating. But actually, the Enneagram, Ennea means 9, gramma means drawing in Greek. Enneagram is a 9-pointed drawing that represents 9 energetic neural propensities of human beings. And I use that language based
neural on propensities.
Neural propensities. And that comes from Dan Siegel, Dr. Dan Siegel, who actually wrote the foreword of the book, who is a very dear friend to the man that I co-wrote the book with, whose name is Dr. David Daniels. They formed something called the Brain Group. And the Brain Group started studying the correlation between our neural proclivities and propensities, what we might have called for centuries a disposition or your innate character.
That's a way of describing people.
Yeah, temperament. You know, we use these words loosely. And Dan Siegel and Dr. David Daniels and several others on this Brain Group have kind of looked at what is the correlation between the way we are organized as far as our central nervous system and our entire biological system and the way our personalities comes out. And it's not accidental and it's not random. Actually, the whole thing is incredibly intelligently organized. And each one of us comes in organized in a particular way to receive and perceive the environment and the experiences of our lives and also bring an experience to the world, bring a particular talent to the world. And these talents actually contribute to the survival of the collective. Each one of us brings a gift that helped the species survive. There happens to be 9 definitive temperaments, and what I'm calling temperaments and neural proclivities or Enneagram types. These 9 temperaments were discovered by researchers Thomas and Chess back in the 70s through the 90s. They studied infants 3 months to 18 months old, and they found definitively 9 patterns of reception and interaction with the world that were very identifiable. And these map directly to the Enneagram, which is some of the work of Dr. David Daniels, which is on his website.
And he was connected with Stanford, too, right?
Yes, he was. Dr. Daniels was a clinical psychiatrist at Stanford. He was a teacher at Stanford. And Professor Emeritus, he started his own private practice, and he was studying and taking notes on patterns that he was noticing in private practice. And then he got invited to meet a woman named Helen Palmer, and who was teaching the Enneagram and also was a psychic.
Helen Palmer, I think that was
Palmer?
Yeah,
that's right.
They were partners in crime, so to speak.
And he went and took an Enneagram class by Helen Palmer in the early 80s. And he's like, oh, my goodness. These are some of the patterns I've been all by myself documenting alone in my clinical practice. And here it is. And it's been well documented and people are speaking to it. So he started studying the Enneagram in secret, we'll call it, because the Enneagram comes from more of the mystical, esoteric
study.
So
that's like Sufi or something like
yeah.
that?
It's, yeah, it's the movement aspect of it.
From the Iranian world.
The archetypal yeah. aspect of it comes from the Sufis and from someone named Gurdjieff.
Yes.
But 2-3 years later, he said, I can't keep this a secret anymore, and he brought it to Stanford, and he risked his career, basically. Put his career on the line, brought it to Stanford, and truthfully, he really is one of the fathers of the Enneagram in the United States, because he endorsed it with his career, with his status at Stanford in such a huge way. And they opened the first International Enneagram Conference in 1994 at Stanford, which was a real game changer for the movement.
So is this promise to have a common language that psychologists, psychoanalysts can use for understanding the human nature more
Absolutely.
Specifically?
So the work of Dan Siegel has been pivotal in bringing this to the mainstream. As a matter of fact, Dan Siegel happens to be the psychiatrist or psychotherapist for Chelsea Handler. I don't know if you're aware of this, but she just did a podcast with her therapist, and the whole podcast was about the Enneagram, because she's learned that she is a type 8 on the Enneagram, and she's found it life-changing. So thanks to her and Dan Siegel and several books bringing it to the mainstream, but actually there is a huge need for it to continue to be brought to the academic circles and psychotherapy circles. For sure.
Yeah,
and
I am a huge
part of that.
Fan of the Enneagram as a creative writer because of the insight that it gives me to the characters, the potential complexity of the characters that are in the creative process when you're trying to tell a story.
Absolutely.
And, well, you know, what impressed me was also the idea that you had to come up with your own Enneagram number, that it's not something that's given to you because of birth date or location on the planet necessarily.
Unlike astrology.
Yeah.
It's not
so
in the stars.
So it's
in your own
It's some kind of self-analysis that is necessary for it to even begin to work.
So Al, you've just shared something that is so critical to the study of the Enneagram that's very different than current modern day psychotherapy, where you go in and sit in front of someone and they do the diagnosis based on all their training.
The
and so they've got all the knowledge and you sit there and you're being looked into, so to speak. The Enneagram is a self-assessment tool for understanding myself and understanding others. And it is one of the only such tools out there for us to assess, understand, and self-engage. So I can diagnose myself. I can understand myself. I can gain the insights into myself. And also, of course, the Enneagram provides a beautiful community for group understanding and group sharing. And to all the great therapists out there and all of the training that they get. But unless I have the understanding, I don't go that far. It's awesome that someone with years and years of experience can tell me what's going on with me. But unless I understand it and unless I can see into myself, I'm kind of swimming upstream without a
paddle. So the first step is figure out how to do it, turn it into yourself, and then you can start looking at others then, too.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get into that a little bit after break. We're going to look at some people that we've all know about and how they would rate on the Enneagrams or how they would be perceived. We'll be right back. We're talking to Suzanne Dion, Dr. and Mrs. Future Show. I guess it's time to raise a little hell here. So, Suzanne, you were saying that perhaps some understanding, some people in the news might give us a handle on how the Enneagram could facilitate our understanding of the world and the way things are unfolding. So, like, let's look at somebody in the head. Can you give us somebody like that?
So let me share, first of all, there are nine distinctive temperaments that have been discovered and validated. I'll call them temperaments right now, Enneagram types. There's nine of them.
Okay.
And
you want to give us a basic the name of each of them? At least,
yeah, so one is the perfectionist or reformer. Two is the helper, the giver. Three is the performer, achiever. Four is the individualist, romantic. Five is called the observer, investigator, sometimes the hermit. Six is the loyal skeptic, the worrier. Seven, the epicure.
Bon vivant.
The kind of a bon vivant. Uh-huh. The eight is the boss, the challenger. Nine is the mediator or the harmonizer.
So like a president would be an eight or something, or
well,
CEO? Or,
well, kind of sometimes. So yeah. These, I recommend no one gets hooked up on the actual names. That each of these numbers are more energetic ways that we are organized. So way your central nervous system is organized to bring particular aptitudes to the world. And we receive and perceive data a certain way. And we also have a neurally identified focus of attention. And this is really, really important. We all don't focus on the same thing, and that's not an accident. It's highly intelligently organized. If every one of us in the tribe focused on procuring the animal for dinner, nobody would know how to cook it. So we would have been lost millions of years ago. So some of us are tuned into preparing, and some of us are tuned into gathering, and some of us are tuned into nurturing, and some of us are thinking about the weather and surviving. And these ways of focusing our attention are incredibly important to the human species. So these nine ways we focus of our attention are actually part of a whole. We are already whole as a collective, as a humanity, contributing to each other. So now let's take this information and why is it important? Unless I understand that my attention focuses differently than my beloved, I could stand there and say to them, "What is wrong with you? How come you don't see this
all the time?"
Right?
And we attack. A great relationship ends that moment.
That's right. We attack each other because we see things differently. We perceive data differently. We interpret information differently. Now, our neural proclivities is one piece of this. Childhood development and trauma is another piece of this. And we could talk for that all day long. Sure. But going back to understanding these nine temperaments, these nine proclivities, our focus of attention, and who's in the news right now and what's going on, and understanding these perspectives, these different focuses of attention, helps us to have tremendous compassion for each other, helps us listen with curiosity instead of immediately forming a defense, what is wrong with him that he sees it that way. And we can be grateful that someone sees something different and realize that thank God for people that see something different than me, because they have allowed my DNA to survive until today, right? Because we're all contributing. So one of the things I found fascinating right now, of course, Trump is always on everybody's tip of their tongue, but this beautiful little girl, Greta Thunberg, who is taking all of us by storm, this
and
passionate...
And has inspired youth all over the world to come up to their leaders and insist that the leaders use science to cultivate policy to protect us all from a changing climate.
Yes, absolutely. And didn't Margaret Mead say it only takes one, right? And look at this little girl.
Well, some people take an exception to her because she seems to be shaming adults. You know, and I said, how can a kid really know what's really going on?
Yeah, 16-year-olds always think that they have all the solutions, and they don't have the sophistication to know that many people are doing the best they can.
Yeah, I mean, even if they get a lot of teenage support, that's the counter argument.
Nevertheless, righteous anger.
What kind of personality
is a place for righteous anger?
Anger, son, is exactly right.
Righteous anger.
While the Enneagram is a self-assessment tool, we call it an inside job. It's the one system that allows me to go in and watching my patterns of thinking, feeling, and behaving, I determine my Enneagram type, my neural focus.
Okay, so first
of all,
go into your own space?
Of course.
So
you are the authority. It's not outside yourself.
So when you're assessing Greta, you look at yourself first and then her.
Well, here's the thing. Technically, we don't want to type others, quote unquote.
Yeah, because only Greta could type Greta. But we can guess.
We
can say that our observations of her fit this profile.
And here's what's helpful with the Enneagram. Of course, you study the Enneagram. First, you learn about yourself. And then you also start recognizing people in your lives. And you start recognizing your loved ones in particular. And then from a distance, we can also see particular things. And as you study the Enneagram, you learn how different types speak. There's syntax, choice of words. There's body language. There's all kinds of things that go into the way we're designed, the way we present ourselves, the way we care about things, which emotion tends to jump forward, what we tend to pay attention to. This little gal, righteous anger, and you say you feel some shaming. My suspicion, as an outsider who studied the Enneagram as much as I have, and being really taken by her, is probably a little type one. Now, type one is a perfectionist reformer. She starts her speech by, "This is wrong. So right and wrong language, black and white thinking, you often see polarized in type 1s, some other types as well, but type 1s. Yeah. I should be in school. I should be in school.
But
I should not be here.
I'm sacrificing to
She's
tell you this.
She's fighting with reality.
Yeah.
She's arguing with what is. She is not accepting the status quo. And the anger, anger is such a mobilizing, beautiful, energetic force when we feel violated.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
So she's right on target. She's really purely feeling violated. You are betraying me, taking my childhood. This is a little reformer crusader in front of us, probably a social one, which is one of the instincts that tie to the Enneagram, which I won't have time to go into.
Like a Joan of Arc?
Very much so, absolutely. Yeah. So some of the big movers and shakers, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, they've been reported as type ones. So you see this type of, we are going to mobilize for change in the type one structure. A woman named Susan Olesik, who I was very, very closely involved with for several years, starting Enneagram Prison Project, is a social one. I'm going to go in and reform the prison system. We're going to take the Enneagram into prison. We're going to work with the marginalized and with those who would never have a chance to learn this.
Did that happen?
It absolutely happened. Enneagram Prison Project is growing today and is something that I'm devoted to continuing in my own work. And,
so do you actually go into prisons?
Yes. San Quentin, San Mateo County, Santa Clara County, Maine Jail, and Elmwood Correctional Facilities all have ongoing classes that study the Enneagram for the purpose of self-awareness, self-compassion development. Without the compassion, awareness is torture. So let me explain that. You start to see that you're impacting people very badly. Let's say you have a very shaming style of speech. Mm-hmm. And you don't realize you're shaming people. You know, you should have done that. You should have thought about that. I can't believe you didn't do that. Those are all shaming ways of speaking. So you start to realizing that you're hurting people with your speech.
Well, in her case, it's like we left the planet in a mess.
But without compassion for the self, understanding that your gift is to come in and crusade. Your gift is you're trying to create change. So to have compassion for your intention.
That's true. We should love the great reformers of history, right?
Yep.
We wouldn't have a lot of the virtues that we have without the righteous anger saying, no more, we're not going to take this anymore.
So if you become aware of your righteous anger without having compassion for the higher intention of it, you could really beat yourself up. And
well,
we don't want
that. That's the
thing.
Righteous anger does not have to be violent.
That's right.
It can be illuminating.
That's right. Look at Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. Look at what he did for 25 years behind bars. All the guards fell in love with him. He did nothing but deliver love, stood in his greatness, and he ended up wearing down the people around him that were supposed to hate him. And and
love wins in the end.
Yeah, love wins in the end, but self-compassion is the big piece. So to study the Enneagram, understanding yourself through using the system to understand the way you're naturally wired brings a lot of compassion for why you've gotten caught in certain liabilities of your personality. Because once you have compassion and you don't beat yourself up, now you can get curious and you can enhance your qualities without shaming yourself or harming yourself, which we do see a lot of.
Well, we have to go to a break really soon, but I have a question, like, how do you begin to recognize when you are shaming or experiencing yourself out of balance? And how does the Enneagram help with that? But I have to say, we have to get another traffic report in right now, so it's probably a good question to come back to. All right.
All right.
With Suzanne Dion, the author of The Enneagram, Relationships and Intimacy. And this is the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show. And now...
You are failing us. But the young people are starting to understand your betrayal. The eyes of all future generations are upon you. And if you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you. We will not let you get away with this. Right here, right now, is where we draw the line. The world is waking up, and change is coming, whether you like it or not. Thank you.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show. Mrs. Future, you had a question for Suzanne Dion?
Yes. Well, we were just talking about the very emotional subject of shaming, and especially in response to righteous anger and the current political movement of the youth versus government in terms of taking responsibility for climate change and using science and the actions of Greta.
You left the planet in a mess. Shame on you.
That's right. So let's just talk about shaming. And what do we do with shaming? How do we recognize it? What is the most beneficial way of handling that energy, both internally for ourselves and when we see it in others? What do we do?
So shame is a very powerful topic. All 9 Enneagram types, all temperaments experience being shamed and experiencing shame inside of ourselves. And all 9 types could have a proclivity or a tendency to shame others. Now, some Enneagram types tend to use shaming outside of the self and inside of the self more than others. Particularly type 1s are known for the finger pointing, shaming, you should have, you shouldn't have. We can tend to go to that, especially more heavily traumatized a type 1 is from their own childhood, the more tendency they could have to shaming others externally and also shaming themselves with a very powerful negative inner critic on the inside.
Now, how common is shaming right now in our culture?
Shame is an enormous problem in child rearing. I'll start with that. Shaming can be very, very debilitating. A lot of parenting styles are normalized toward shaming children into behavior and shaming children into conditional love. So just
so it's like, if you don't do what I say, then you're bad. Give us a good
example.
You're
so bad. Oh my God, you should have known better. Well, how do you know better when you're 3? We are over traumatizing children through making them feel unacceptable for shouting too loudly, jumping on the bed, falling on their head. I mean, uneducated.
So if they,
dare
if
I say,
child,
parents can really, they can use shame to control or parent and not realize the damage that it's doing. Because what happens is shame gets internalized. The way we talk to our children is the way they will later on speak to themselves. And we have to realize the critical nature.
In their own inner voice, their inner critics.
Absolutely, absolutely.
They hear their mother's voice.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, timeouts are one of the worst traumatizing events. It supposedly replaced spanking in the past few generations, but timeouts is conditional love. Yeah. I'm going to threaten you with our attachment relationship until you behave the way I want you to, which means you need to betray yourself. You need to stop what you're doing. Maybe you have feelings that need to be addressed that I'm not going to address with you as a parent. You need to go over there and soothe yourself. Oh, you're only 3. How do you soothe yourself? This causes lifelong damage.
And we can't hit you. Oh, well, how about excommunication?
Exactly.
But is there a better alternative? I mean, what do you think the modern parent can do with the misbehaving child?
Nurture.
And
attunement.
What does that look like?
Resonance. So it's getting down with the child. How are you feeling? Tell me what's happening. Or holding. Literally, what the child needs most when they're screaming and acting out and having a tantrum. Now, I'm a mother, so I'm speaking from experience. You have a child who's in a tantrum state. A tantrum state is a high level of frustration on its way to central nervous system overwhelm. The child needs nurturance. But we have normalized cutting him off in that moment, thinking that if I nurture him now, I'm going to spoil him. I'm going to create more tantrums. Mm. That's actually not what happens. We have an epidemic. I'm going to be really bold here. We have an epidemic of really bad parenting that has been normalized for generations of time. Mm. Children put in childcare at 6 weeks old, spare the rod, spoil the child, tough love, discipline at all costs, you know. Mm. And shaming is a piece of that. But going back to your initial question, how do I recognize shame if I'm I'm shaming others. Let's start with that first. And then there's shaming of the self. Shaming others comes out in language. It is a language exchange. You should have known better. Can't believe you haven't done that yet. These are shaming statements. Wow, can't believe you said that after everything you've studied for years. These are all shaming statements.
What about how dare you?
How dare you, right? To take away someone's power. So shaming on the outside, I would suggest we start to look at our language. Now, I'm an Enneagram type one. I call myself a recovering type one. And I was a little girl that put everybody in line as a child. When people would come to visit my house and they take off their shoes and they had a hole in their sock, I would point it out to them. You have a hole in your sock and you shouldn't have that. I was like little Greta.
So you're a good shamer, were you?
I was a good shamer. And that was just the way I saw the world.
You were right. And yet, how does that help that other people receive that message? What's the virtue here?
Well, what you want to do with self-awareness is you start to realize, what is the impact on connection, my connection to others, when I'm pointing out their fault when they haven't asked, when I'm distancing myself from them in a superior position and making someone feel inferior? What's that doing for me? So the more traumatized I might have gotten as a child, the more I would have hung on to those behaviors and felt lifted by them, let's call it. I would have gotten a little benefit from scolding.
Sure, it's the old, I'm right. You get the right-gasm.
Yeah, and people that haven't worked out their own trauma will often still, in their adulthood, be using language in this manner and not realizing that there's an impact, because the more traumatized we are, oftentimes the less impact we realize we're having on others. We're completely non-receptive to
but
it.
But what about, I am very receptive to Greta's message that the government is not responsive to the needs of the human beings on the planet.
Absolutely.
And they're busy talking about things that aren't relevant instead of solving the problem.
So absolutely.
How do I appropriately respond to the emotional truth of the fact that something needs to be done? We need to address this.
Now, I want to clarify, I personally, because I understand her temperament and I am completely enthralled in this girl's passion and bravery and courage. And I think her message, what she's doing is she's taken the filter and thrown it all the way to the right and say, look, I'm angry. And finally,
yes,
you know, it is that level of anger that creates change. And coming from someone so young is so powerful.
And she probably has a lot of supportive scientists to help her become educated in this.
She just wrote a statement on Facebook, because everyone's saying there's people behind her and she's being paid and people are writing her speeches, and none of that is happening.
This is pure emotion, pure
a little girl
authentic,
who probably comes from this neural proclivity, who is on display with every ounce of conviction and passion she has, and she is not intentionally shaming. This is her focus of attention and the way she presents
and
her
so
passion.
What does a one do once they have expressed this frustration? Where does the solution arrive from? How do we take it to the most positive outcome?
Well, look what's happening. She's mobilizing impact. And she's mobilizing change. We've got children protesting all over the world. She's speaking at the UN. She's just at a TED talk. She's on every talk show. She has mobilized energy.
All right, but is she making it okay to the kids to shame their parents?
Yeah. I mean, as an older person who's of the generation that's being shamed here, I'm like, hey, wait a minute. I'm a blue marble cheerleader here. I'm trying to make the world a better place. How come you're coming after me just because I'm old?
Yeah, you know, she's provocative. Yeah. And, you know, she doesn't realize she's shaming. She's speaking from her
that's
core.
That's true. Yeah, she's not seeing it as a shaming
problem.
She's just concerned about the planet, and that's how it comes out.
It is the way a little type one who's completely impassioned speaks.
That's having compassion for a point of view.
Absolutely. This is what type one does in the world. And oftentimes they do come out with this huge ball of fire, and they do create change. And this is why we love them.
Do they ever find that they've made a mistake? Do they ever find that they need to come at the situation again after they've given it their fire and address maybe a different approach?
So, son, now you're speaking of something called level of developmental well-being. So we have the way that we are neurally organized, our focus of attention, and then we have how we were nurtured or not. So our level of developmental health determines our potential for self-awareness, for metacognition, to see ourselves, to have response flexibility, to resonate with others. The more traumatized we are, the lower our developmental level of well-being, the less receptive we are, the more blockheaded we are, the more fixated we are in our story, the more right we have to be. All nine types have to be right when they're severely traumatized and they're unself-aware.
Hmm.
So the more self-aware we become as a type one, let's say, oh, there's another way of looking at it. Now, I was a classic in my 20s. What's wrong with you? That was my language, right? If you didn't see it my way. But now I'm in my 50s and I'm like, oh,
you can.
There's lots of possibility here. And I'm learning to receive information a lot differently than I did in my 20s. And that's the gift of becoming more aware of my fixated position becomes an open and fluid position where I allow others, I learn from feedback.
Right? So you don't have to be wrong as much as you have to be open to the other potential points of view of looking at the situation.
Yes, absolutely.
You can still be right, but you can be one among many.
So let's make this real personal here. What if you had a chance to speak to Greta directly and face to face, what would you tell her?
Go, girl. Go, girl. Just bring all of you. She's 16. She's bringing everything she has. And I stand back in reverence of her courage. And I also, I find it fascinating watching her be received by the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, how beautiful to see someone so passionate about what's happening. It's very confusing for all of us to understand what is happening. Is there climate change? Is there not? Is the news accurate? Is it not? We're all very confused, but what I can see in her is, wow. With that level of conviction and passion and willingness to expose herself and put herself out there, that's a Joan of Arc. Mm. That's a Nelson Mandela. That's a William Wallace. You know, these people were and have been on this planet and have created very, very necessary and valuable change because they care so much. And that's something you can always say about type one. They care so much. And anger is the driving emotional system of type one, which you can see in her.
Well, truth is one of these things. Truth is either absolutely true and everyone can find it, which is the belief of the scientists, or truth is variable, as said by the main character in Cloud Atlas.
No,
Cloud Atlas. She says truth is singular, but what you're asking is, I forget the great quote. Anyway, but there are many points of view.
Yes.
And yet that's not what truth is.
That's right. That's right. These are perspectives, and we need them all.
Yes. Yeah, we're going to take some calls and questions from the audience after the break.
Yes, yes.
Talking to Suzanne
Dion.
The
phone is lit up, and we will be right back after this. Thanks. And I find it kind of funny. I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you because I find
okay, welcome back to the show. Now, we have a question from Norman. He asks you, how does the Enneagram map to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders? That's what psychiatrists use for ascertaining...
Yeah, disorders as opposed to positive personality types.
So you have a thing for demented minds?
Well, you know, it's a fabulous question because it points us to what modern day therapists and those trained in that side of academics for mental health are working with. And the DSM is this great big thick book, and it bullet point lists all types of mental health disorders. In the early 80s, I believe, a man named Claudio Naranjo, which is one of the founders and teachers of the Enneagram, he just passed away a couple months ago in his 90s. He actually mapped the Enneagram to the DSM personality disorders. Let me share this. So each of these nine temperaments have different ways of being organized. And when they're traumatized, we don't always exactly look the same under trauma. So when we're faced with trauma, the temperament comes up with its best solution and particular defenses based on the gifts in its temperament to survive. And we're not going to reach for the weakest part of ourselves when we have someone beating the shit out of us every day.
Yeah, that happens.
So the temperament will come up with the solution for the trauma. And that solution looks a little different. So with each temperament that goes down under trauma, you see different pieces of the mental health pathology show up. So type ones definitely go to OCD, and type twos can go to histrionic personality disorder. Type threes go to narcissistic disorder. Type fours go to borderline. Type fives go to schizoid affective and paranoia, some of the cluster A personality disorders. So they all map. Type eight goes to and antisocial personality disorder. So the nine types, actually, Claudio Naranjo very specifically mapped to that particular temperament at the bottom of itself, at its most pathological and dysfunctional, and basically at its most in pain representation of self. That's what trauma does to us.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I hope that answers your question, Norm. Yeah. All right, thumbs up on that.
We got a few callers here.
Okay, let's take our callers. We only have a few minutes here. Let's get them in here.
Okay, and first we have Colonel Terry. And hi, Colonel Terry. You have a correction, I hear.
Hello, beautiful lady. Suzanne, what is her name, please?
Suzanne Dion.
Okay, Suzanne, you are just splendid at your work and
Thank you.
Let me compliment it highly. And in addition to that, however, the correction I have for the very intelligent Mrs. Future and almost equally intelligent Dr. Future is that your audience is going to be confused with the word anagram and anagram. Anagram, of course, is to rearrange letters beginning with A-N-A-G-R-A-M. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about is enneagram.
Well, we did spell it out. Yeah. We did.
E-double-N-E-A-G-R-A-M of personality. Again, E-double-N-E-A-G-R-A-M. Which is the nine, and of course, it's from the Greek word nine.
That's right. Were you listening when our guest actually explained that?
Oh, I didn't hear that part. Sorry. At any rate,
thank you.
The point being, dear, that you've got to clarify for the audience, it's the nine personality types in the Greek nine,
yes.
So people don't go look N-A-N-G-R-A-M and get confused like I first
did. Yes, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. People do misspell it all the time and get confused.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other thing you want to say?
Well, I was going to say we do have another caller. Oh, okay. Did you have anything else?
I want to compliment your work. And what personality type would Mrs. Future describe herself, is my question.
Okay, son. Let's have her share.
I'm a bon vivant.
Seven, huh?
Absolutely. No. I live for joy, and I am an idealistic visionary who really loves life. That is my characteristic, my temperament. Thanks for asking.
You're welcome, beautiful.
And of course, I'd love for everybody to be able to benefit from this personality study.
What do you think Colonel Terry is, a five?
Oh, I don't know. What are you, Colonel Terry?
I'm a perfectionist, an indignant perfectionist.
Indignant perfectionist.
Go, type one. There you go.
Brianne, why don't you read all the choices at some point in the program if you have time?
Yeah, maybe you got to hang out with Brenna.
Okay. I encourage you to listen to the first part of the interview, Colonel Terry, because we did do all this in the beginning.
Okay,
so maybe
I will do that anyway.
Thanks.
The program is wonderful, and so are you both.
Thank you.
All right. So next we have Nick from Boulder Creek who disagrees with, who knows, we'll find out. Are you ready? Here we go. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I'm just a little concerned. Your guest was there praising this little girl, the 16-year-old, who was spouting at the United Nations. It's great that she has a voice. And it's great that she's very passionate about what she's doing. But I think that what we're doing to these children is really a disservice to them. I remember as a child, global cooling. I remember being very concerned in the second grade because the ozone layer, they did the fear of global cooling when I was a kid. So I started paying attention to all of this. And I've noticed that politics and the environment go hand in hand. And they sway one way and sway to another. And I don't know if you guys remember the religious group, some people call them cult group, whatever, but they're called Jehovah Witnesses. And in the old days, pre-1970, they had predicted the end of the world roughly 3 to 4 different times and actually had the nerve to print the end of the world time. They went out and preached it. Mm-hmm. Well, now I heard this little girl screaming and basically crying that we only have 12 years, we only have 12 years, and this drum beat that I'm hearing for the past month now, ever since that AOC, that crazy lady from New York, since she started saying 12 years, now they're all saying 12 years. So it's like they find a mantra and then they beat it to death. Now, should we be concerned? Absolutely. We should definitely monitor and reduce and recycle and reuse and be good stewards to the land. But I think to instill fear into these children like this, I think it really truly does them a disservice.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Wow. That's a great perspective.
Yeah, what do you think of that, instilling fear in the kids?
I really appreciate your perspective on that. Talking about her today specifically was highlighting quite possibly her Enneagram temperament, which is pretty clear in the way she's presenting herself and her conviction and the words and the linguistics that she's using. But I remember as a child being terrified of the ozone too. And I can remember this, you know, fatalistic thinking that I think all of us are subjected to right now in the news and the media. I think we're all a little traumatized by a lot of it. So I take your point as very valid.
Yeah, and also very good point about being able to give people false information for politics. And yet we still, as a society, as a civilization, need to have a conversation about what is the path forward and what information can serve us. And I think everybody will agree that we're living in really strange climates. We're living in very hot, hot seasons. It seems like the seasons are not happening in the times that they used to when we were growing up. There's the worst flooding. We're having really epic problems. And for the government to act like that's not happening and somehow somebody's just lying to us, that doesn't serve the conversation to just deny.
Well, the one thing I shared with my beloved the other day was that we have been tracking weather for what, I don't know, 200-300 years maybe as a humanity. And how could we possibly think we have a handle on what the weather does with just 200 years of tracking? Maybe the earth changes all the time and that's natural.
And that maybe the only issue is that as humans, we always survive, but we have to be flexible enough to survive. But it's not going to be just like the way it has been.
Well, I think we're getting better at having better communications with the planet in various ways. You know, everything from all the satellites and the sensors that we have through our technology, and also from shamanically, from tuning into the planet as a living organism. I mean, we have a lot of resources at our disposal as a multidimensional species to deal with this more consciously.
And what is the proper response to genuine fear, just like righteous anger? Mm-hmm. How do we as human beings have that conversation without making the messenger the bad guy?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the higher virtue of fear turns to courage. So the courage to look, the courage to investigate, the courage to be curious, the courage to stand in the face of what seems scary and study and learn.
So sadly, we're almost out of time here. Let's mention your book.
Thanks for all the comments, everybody.
Yeah, and how it can be attained. I suppose you're on Amazon.
Yes, it's the Enneagram Relationships and Intimacy by Dr. David Daniels and Suzanne Dion on Amazon.
Okay, the Enneagram Relationships and Intimacy. Understanding one another leads to loving better and living more fully. Okay, so it's all about increasing our understanding of each other, Enneagram, relations, and intimacy. It's almost like a textbook. You feel like I read this, I'm going to get a degree.
You might. Wow, today went really fast, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Suzanne, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You're just wonderful. Thanks for being here.
All right, that's it for another Future Tuesday.
Yes. We'll see you next week. We'll probably have a report from Greg and Richard on the big Oculus event happening this weekend.
It's KSEO Santa Cruz. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.